You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Sheriff Richard Mack. Sheriff, thanks for joining us today.
Well, for having me. I appreciate being with you again, Dave.
Sheriff, I had just completed your book, The Magic of Gun Control, and boy, what a powerful book, and really got me fired up. And this book really, it got me angry a lot, because you just have a way of explaining things. I mean, I didn't think of these things before, and the way that you explain them, it's very clear after you read them, but before that, I never thought that way. And I think that for people to really understand where you're coming from, it's so important for them to not just get the book, but read the entire thing, because there's so many tidbits in there. What motivated you to write this book, The Magic of Gun Control?
Well, I think the very title of it did. The Magic of Gun Control. In fact, this was part of the reason the title was chosen. I've actually had people come up and say, "You think gun control's good?" I said, "Well, obviously you don't know who I am or you wouldn't ask that question."
Right.
But I would say, well, first of all, is there such a thing as magic? And no, there isn't. Magic is something that Disneyland tries to portray, but it's all an illusion.
Right.
When you go into Pirates of the Caribbean or the Haunted Castle or any of those things, it's all mirrors and illusions. David Copperfield is another one I mentioned in the book even. I've been to his show in Las Vegas, and if you've never been to that show, it is absolutely the most entertaining thing I've ever seen in Las Vegas. And I've been to a lot of shows in Vegas.
Right.
David Copperfield is mind-blowing because you actually think that maybe magic is possible because his illusions are so absolutely amazing. So I say, if you want magic, go to Disneyland or go see David Copperfield. But still, this is all an illusion. And the magic of gun control is being promoted by the best illusionists in America. And as you know, I created a new word for the book, and that is polymagician.
Right.
And polymagician is plain and simply a politician who pretends to be a magician. He wants you to believe, or she, that all the failed policies that history has made very clear to us that have been complete failures, that have only been destructive and damaging and enslaving and destroyers of freedom and liberty and personal rights, that somehow in America today, they're magic. They'll work now, even though they've never worked before in world history. They'll work because we say so, and we're really good politicians, and we're really good polymagicians. We'll make gun control work in America. Yeah, we know Hitler did it, and it didn't work. We know Mussolini did it. We know Castro did it. We know Pol Pot did it. We know all these horrible communist dictators promoted gun control, and it never worked, and we know it was racist, and we know it was enslaving, and we know it was destructive, but in America, we can do it now because it's magic. People fall for that crap. I not only bring up the magic associated with the lure and lies of gun control,
right,
but a lot of other things happening in Washington, D.C. as well. Land rights and political correctness in general, the destruction of our Constitution, Fast and Furious, and many other things of propaganda and media hype that try to destroy our Constitution and freedom. But there's none more starkly and vividly apparent than the issue of gun control, because the Second Amendment makes it very clear. If you look at the historical perspective of our Constitution and what the Founding Fathers said about the Second Amendment. You know, the actual people who devised and developed the Second Amendment, you should check in with them. Don't check in with one of your polymagicians of today. Check in with the people who wrote the Second Amendment and the Constitution and see what they intended the Second Amendment to be. When you look at that, you know that in America, gun control is against the law. And all of that is detailed in the book.
Right. And on the first page of the book, about this book, when you bring up the term polymagicians, you say that, I guess, the polymagicians couldn't do what they do without the help of their beautiful assistants.
Yeah.
And who are they?
The media is the beautiful assistant. In fact, the media is the beautiful assistant enabler. The beautiful assistant up on stage with the polymagician knows full well the tricks going on, knows very full well the illusions going on, and are accomplices in making the audience believe the illusion, because she acts like she believes it and she's a part of it.
Right.
The media in America today are the same ones making sure we go along, that we believe, and that we accept the illusions of the polymagicians.
Right. It's all very insidious. I guess the main motivator for writing this book was the fact that you were the first sheriff to sue the Clinton administration over the Brady Bill. And of course, a couple of other sheriffs jumped in, but you were the first. And as you say here on page 8, only 7 sheriffs out of over 3,000 sheriffs were involved in the lawsuit.
Yeah, that's true. And it's sad in a way that there wasn't a lot more involvement from other sheriffs. But I'm proud of the 7 that did it. And I'm proud that I was the first one, and probably the first one in American history, and the only time that a sheriff has ever actually sued the federal government, specifically in this case, the Clinton administration, took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won.
Amazing stuff. And you also say, and I didn't mention this previously, but you say in your other book, The County Sheriff, America's Last Hope, you say that on page 35 that you wish you had never filed the lawsuit against the federal government.
Philosophically, because I'm really glad I had that lawsuit now to look back on and to document what we went through and what we did and what it did for America. But in all technical terms, no one should have to go to court and ask permission to keep his oath of office. We don't have to go to court to tell the federal government, you're out of line and we're not going along. In fact, a sheriff in Montana, Sheriff Nixon, actually did just that. He had more courage than I did, and he just told them he wasn't going to do the Brady Bill in his county, and there's nothing you can do about it. And he was right, and nothing did happen to him. You know, I was considering that at one time, but being all by myself and having no other support from any other sheriff that I was aware of at the time, certainly none in Arizona were supporting me. I just thought that this was my only way out. Now I can look back at it and see the Lord's hand in it. I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad we won a case at the U.S. Supreme Court. But I will still maintain that the proper way to do it would have been simply to say, no, you're not my boss, you can't tell me what to do, and I'm not doing it. I would have liked to have done that with many other sheriffs, which is what I'm trying to get sheriffs to do today and realize you can do the same today without going to court. The time and money that it takes to go to court, if it hadn't been for the NRA, I wouldn't have been able to afford this at all in any way.
Right. And I guess ultimately it's a great thing that you did file the lawsuit, because if you would have done what Sheriff Nixon did, yeah, you would have been successful. They wouldn't have done anything, but so few sheriffs would have really been aware of the reality of it.
Correct. And we wouldn't have a precedent-setting court case that really reinforces everything I say in the book.
Right. And on page 2, you say, this is the first time in American history that Congress promulgated legislation which required a state or county official to comply with an unfunded federal mandate under a threat of arrest.
Yeah. People think I'm crazy, and they think I make some of this stuff up. Yes, in the Brady Bill, first of all, it was an unfunded mandate, an unconstitutional mandate from several different angles. And then they say, okay, sheriffs, you're going to conduct these federal background checks for us for free. You're going to use your resources, your budget, your personnel entirely. There's no money attached. There's no grants. And if you don't, you're subject to a 1 year in jail or a $10,000 fine or both. So first time in U.S. history, they wanted to commandeer the office of sheriff for federal bidding under a threat of arrest if we failed to comply.
Okay.
Sound reasonable. I guess that, I guess we should just all accept that, bow down and say, oh, yes, thank you, federal government. Kiss the ring on the hand of the federal government and just go on.
Right.
Because the other sheriffs at this same meeting, they were more ticked off about it than I was. And I was the youngest sheriff in the state at the time when the BATF came to our sheriff's meeting and told us about all this and dropped this bomb on us that we were subject to arrest if we didn't go along. And all the other sheriffs, man, they were cussing up a storm, and they totally convinced me that there's no way we could go along. And then at the end of the day, all the other sheriffs started acquiescing and saying, well, I don't like it, but there's nothing we can do about it. We'll just have to go along as best we can. Mm. At least 5 sheriffs said, you can't fight City Hall. You got to be kidding me. Who wants you to believe that?
Exactly.
City Hall.
Exactly. The same people who think that, hey, has the IRS come after you yet?
Yeah.
Same way of thinking. James Brady was President Reagan's press secretary, and on March 30th, 1981, I think that was the date that there was an assassination attempt on Reagan, and of course then Brady became an ardent supporter of gun control. So you actually met him, you say in the book, I think it's on page 9, you say that he was very pleasant, but his wife wasn't.
No, she wasn't. Sarah Brady and I debated each other on Good Morning America a couple of times and on the Phil Donahue show and several other places and several radio shows. And she exploited her husband's injury. Her husband was shot in the head during that assassination attempt that you mentioned on President Reagan's life. He got it the worst and was maimed for life and was confined to a wheelchair.
Right.
And when we went to the Supreme Court, Mr. Brady was there. I went over and spoke to him, introduced myself, shook his hand. He told me he really admired me for what I had done. And he was very engaging and pleasant. But his wife, in all the times that I had met her and gone against her, she was never pleasant. And in fact, I will say that I think that she not only exploited her husband, she lied about the Constitution, she lied about these laws, and she lied about gun control. And she promoted this thing, pretending, again, being a polymagician or illusionist herself, that gun control would be magic in America and would have stopped the assassination attempt on Reagan and prevented her husband from getting injured. And those are flat-out lies. would not have done that.
Right, when all the evidence shows otherwise. And I guess the crux of the book is really on page 65, where you say significant historical evidence shows that laws of prohibition actually exacerbate the problem they were supposedly intended to resolve. And that's clear, right?
Yeah, it is. You look at that, no matter what the government has done in decades or literally centuries of history, if the federal government or any government for that matter makes something prohibited, like alcohol, if you look at the 1920s and then when they actually made alcohol against the law in the Roaring Twenties, that created Al Capone. It created the bootleggers. It created the black market. Our laws created the black market.
Right.
And now today, we try to pretend that our laws of prohibition have not created the cartels, that we have not created the black market today for getting marijuana or cocaine or any of these other drugs that are now prohibited. We have created that profit. We have created those cartels and black market. And now we finally caught on after 10 or 11 years of alcohol prohibition that it would be a lot safer and a lot better if we just managed this product and regulated it and taxed it. And why we don't get that today, I'll never know. But man, oh man, if you think the war on drugs has created a problem, wait till you see the war on guns.
What about registration, Sheriff? Is registration something that the federal government is allowed to do?
No, and as a matter of fact, where they try to justify or rationalize any regulatory authority over that which is already guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, I still don't see it.
Right.
They have no regulatory authority over that which is guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. None is offered, none is allowed. And in fact, their only job is to make sure that the Bill of Rights are enforced and guaranteed. That's the purpose of government. And yet, here we go again. They are the ones. Government is the one entity destroying the Bill of Rights, and in particular, the Second Amendment. But no, they cannot regulate how or when or what I do to keep and bear arms.
Somebody should tell them. On page 35, you say, throughout history, where gun registration has been required by law, it has always been followed by confiscation. Always.
Always.
And that's a fact.
There's not one exception to that. Sounds like magic, yeah.
Hey, again, I don't get it. On page 19, you talk about this lawsuit, Warren versus District of Columbia. Just give a little bit of background about that.
Well, that was a girl who was gang raped, and she called the police before the rape occurred and said, look, I need your help. They never responded, or finally did after she'd been raped numerous times. And this was in the Washington, D.C. area. And so, lo and behold, Washington, D.C. has the most strict and stringent gun control laws. So this case, she lost. This Ms. Warren, she lost the case because she took the police to court for failure to protect. And the courts ruled that the police cannot be held liable, at least financially liable, for not protecting you. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So the irony of this case, and the reason I put it in this particular chapter, is because Washington, D.C. says, well, yes, the police cannot be there to protect you, and sometimes will not be there to protect you. We hope to be able to protect you, but don't count on it. And the law says we don't have to. And we'll make another law saying you're not allowed to protect yourself either.
Wow.
So what is a homeowner to do when someone breaks into your home and they're raping your children or they're raping your wife and you can't defend yourself with a gun? Call 911 and hope somebody shows up. And let me tell you right now, there's a book out there that I endorsed about 10 years ago, maybe longer, called Call 911 and Die.
That's perfect.
Because quite frankly, I was in law enforcement for 20 years. I actually supervised 911 communications and e-communications, emergency communications, in the police department I worked for in Utah, and then again when I was sheriff in Arizona. And I can honestly tell you that calling 911 usually results in us coming and investigating you as a victim. Very seldom do we get there in time to stop someone from killing you. It's almost impossible. As a matter of fact, there was a co-ed in Utah, in Salt Lake City, who was calling 911 as a man was breaking in to kill her. And she was actually killed while she was on the phone. 911 should provide no comfort to anyone that your life will be saved.
Right.
If you want to save your own life and you want protection, make sure you have the best tools available to you and your family so that you can protect yourselves. My personal opinion is, and you can look at statistics to bear this out, the best tool to defend yourself with, and yes, this is even and especially for women, women are safe and come out of a would-be attack or rape 83% of the time if they use a gun. There is no other method that brings greater safety and success than a gun. None. Not
right.
calling 911, not yelling, not screaming, not running, not fighting, not blowing a whistle, not mace, not bows and arrows, not knives. Nothing provides better security and safety and success of being safe and sound after a would-be attack than a handgun.
Right.
Nothing.
And as you say on page 16, which sums it all up, this is great. When seconds count, the police are only minutes away.
Every police officer in every shooting incident, whether it's police officer or citizens, every one of those shooting situations literally only last about 15 to 35 seconds.
Wow.
So, yeah, you really think that there's a cop going to be there in time to save you? The average response time in a urban area is 4 to 6 minutes. In rural areas, it's much, much worse.
Hmm. What about Tony Martin? Tell the listeners about this poor fella. Jeez.
Tony Martin, a citizen of England. And he just happened to have a shotgun in his home when some would-be attackers came after him. He ended up shooting them with the shotgun, and he was charged with murder and was sentenced to life in prison. Yeah.
And he's in prison right now.
Actually, I found out that they did commute his sentence because of the overwhelming response from some of the members of parliament and citizens and people like us who have made some outrage about this. I think he ended up serving about 13 years.
13 years
yeah.
for defending
for
himself.
For protecting himself. Yeah. He was being attacked. They were going to kill him. He defended himself with a hunting shotgun, and the press and the government went after him. He had a lousy lawyer besides, and they sentenced him to life in prison for protecting himself from being killed. Yeah.
It's another mystery for me. I can't figure any of this stuff out.
But in the chapter that we were talking about with Miss Warren,
right?
The chapter is Mama shot them. You see, that had nothing to do with Miss Warren, but they're both in Washington, D.C. Mama was actually Rebecca Griffin, and I met her at an NRA convention in California. She was inducted into the NRA Hall of Fame the same time I was. And her case was much different than mine. I never pulled a trigger. She did. But the Warren case is significant because she sued because she didn't have a means to protect herself, so she asked the police to. In Rebecca Griffin's case, who I call Mama, I've actually been in her home where the shooting occurred. In fact, she's a great cook, and I love her Southern cooking.
Nice.
Nobody makes a better sweet potato pie than that woman.
Come on, Sheriff, it's lunchtime. You're getting me hungry.
I know. It's getting me going, too. But some thugs actually broke into her home to stab and kill her daughter, who was a witness against them in a criminal episode in Washington, D.C., drug-related. And so these guys came in to kill the witness, and they were going to burn the home. And Mama actually remembered that she had a little Smith & Wesson revolver in her closet because her boyfriend had left it there. The boyfriend had passed away. She had never shot it before in her life. And these guys break in. She instinctively thought, well, what am I going to do to protect my family? These guys knew that there was no gun in the home because they're against the law in Washington, D.C. But unbeknownst to them, Mama did have a gun. She went and got the gun. She shot both thugs. And immediately, she went into the bathroom and prayed that they would not die. She was a very Christian woman. She didn't want to hurt anybody. She didn't like hurting these guys. But they had already stabbed her and her daughter, had brought the materials into the home to burn the place down. And she was charged also, just like Tony Martin.
Unbelievable.
We're almost as bad as England here.
We're getting
yeah, exactly. We are. But she wasn't charged with murder. She was charged with illegal possession of a firearm, which is a felony. And she could have done 5 to 10 years. So the NRA came to her aid, got her some good lawyers, and she was found not guilty. Can it get any stupider? Literally, can it get any crazier than this? And people say, I'm crazy. What in the world are we doing in this country? We destroy land rights. We destroy gun rights. We destroy families with the IRS. All our money belongs to the federal government, and they allow us to keep a little bit every month or at the end of the year. And then, literally, this is what I really don't get. We actually are required by law, supposed law, to monitor ourselves financially for the federal government, and if we don't do it right, we go to jail.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not accepting that anymore. I am a free man, and I will live without that kind of ridiculous oversight from the federal government. The federal government is supposed to make sure that our borders are protected. They can't even do that. They are required by law to use and have a balanced budget. They can't even do that. And let's remember, while we're trying to blame Barack Obama for everything, Congress holds the purse strings, not Barack Obama. And the reason we are in debt is because we have lying poly magicians in Washington, D.C. who fill the halls of Congress and then want us to come back and believe that they're being our heroes and our champions because they're defending us from Barack Obama. Well, that's a bunch of BS, and it's a bunch of poly magician bullcrap, and they are required to balance the budget. They are required to even have a budget, and they haven't had a budget for 3 years. And so now we're supposed to live by their bureaucratic policies, and we're supposed to go along with all this unconstitutional, un-American destruction as if it has some sort of moral high ground. And we're supposed to watch our Constitution be destroyed and our country be destroyed and our families be destroyed because there's some sort of moral responsibility on our part to do so? No, quite the opposite. And this book, The Magic of Gun Control, yes, it details with great specificity the problems facing our country today. But again, it also offers the solution. And the solution is as old as the Constitution itself. It's the 10th Amendment. It's the people. It's state sovereignty. It's individual initiative. It's working together with local officials to defend, protect, and preserve the United States Constitution. Even more so, the Bill of Rights.
Right. The District of Corruption, Columbia, plays a big part here in the book. On page 88, you talk about District of Columbia versus Heller. What was that all about?
He was an employee who actually got to carry a gun, but Mr. Heller wanted to have one in his home. So he sued. See, he was a special officer for the D.C. police. He used a gun for federal service in the Federal Judicial Center. So he applied for registration certificate for a handgun that he wanted to keep at home, and it was denied. You got to ask permission to keep a gun. Absolutely absurd. And he's a federal employee who is required to have a gun while he's on duty. The local government in D.C., the city government said, no, you can't have a gun. It's against the law. And he took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won in a 5-4 decision. Same as mine. Mine was a 5-4 decision.
Right.
This is absolutely astonishing that a citizen, especially a peace officer, would have to ask permission to keep a gun in his home. But he did, and ultimately he won. And I was amazed by the case because the Supreme Court also ruled similarly in the McDonald versus Chicago. A black man by the name of McDonald.
Right.
Won a case also at the U.S. Supreme Court to keep and bear arms. Chicago could not stop him from exercising his Second Amendment right. But the reason they reinforced the Second Amendment was simply through the 14th Amendment under the clause of equal protection under the law. Why don't they just come out and say, look, the Second Amendment guarantees the right of every citizen to keep and bear arms. The Supreme Court refused to do that, which I find totally astonishing. So in order to do a backdoor approach to the Second Amendment, they used the 14th Amendment. And I found that unnecessary and a little bit superfluous and redundant. You don't need equal protection under the law as guaranteed by the 14th Amendment if you simply tell people, look, the Second Amendment guarantees your right to keep and bear arms. No government, not city governments, not state governments, not Chicago, not D.C., no one has the authority to interfere with your right to keep and bear arms. No infringements are allowed. And the Supreme Court simply could have said, look, the state governments and state government officials are all required by Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution to swear an oath of allegiance to the Constitution. It's simple when you look at it and say, you can't violate the Constitution. You swore an oath not to.
Right.
So anyway, I don't get it. I don't get their approach to it, but I'm glad both McDonald and Heller won. And so, of course, they have significance in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I learned so much from the book. And you're talking about the Second Amendment on page 125. And I had to wrap my mind around this a little bit after I read it. But the Second Amendment did not give men the right to keep and bear arms.
No, it didn't. It just protected the right that we were born with. The right to keep and bear arms was there before 1776. As you'll note, there were several skirmishes between citizens and redcoats before that. And before, in England, you can look at the rights guaranteed in the Magna Carta and the Remonstrance of Rights, was written, I think, in 1688 in England, also had some of these where actually the Bill of Rights was plagiarized from. And so, yeah, citizens had the right to keep and bear arms before 1776. What the Founding Fathers did when they finally devised and developed the Bill of Rights after the Revolutionary War was won, and in 1789 when the Bill of Rights was finally developed, they said, look, let's have a Declaration of Rights that can never be violated. Let's make the Constitution go to the 10th power. Let's take it to the next level. There might be some ambiguities in the Constitution as we hammered it out in Philadelphia in the summer of 1786. 1787, I believe, and then the Bill of Rights in 1789, 2 years later, and said, look, just so there is no question to future generations, just so there's no question to any future tyrant who might become president or powerful in the United States, let's make sure that there is a Declaration of Rights. So they developed the Bill of Rights. So the Founding Fathers, just getting done with King George III and all the abuses, they actually came up with 189. Well, anybody knows that's a little bit too much. They want government to be simple. The entire Constitution can be read in about an hour. And so they didn't want it to be too overburdensome. And so they wanted to keep it simple. So they dwindled them down to 12 basic fundamental rights. The states, then again, ratified 10. 10 of the most basic fundamental rights that government could never violate or change or alter. And the word they used in the Second Amendment was infringe. The right to keep and bear arms could never, by government, be infringed. I'm telling you, we have about 24,000 such infringements that our government officials call laws today. There are over 24,000 gun control laws in America, and they're all unconstitutional.
Incredible. And you say on page 87, where guns are most prevalent, crime is at its lowest. And where gun control is most stringent, crime is at its highest. Don't these geniuses know this?
Well, therein lies the magic again.
Right, there you go, the poly magicians. This book needs to be read by the listeners. It's terrific. It really opened my eyes to a lot of things. On page 103, you say that you are either armed or you are a target. If everybody was armed and they didn't know it, like you say in the book, then they would be less likely to try to commit that crime, right? I mean, it's common sense.
It really is common sense, and it's common law, because it's within the framework of the supreme law of the land, our Constitution. And whether you like guns or not, and this is part of the book as well, whether you like guns or not, whether you approve of guns or not, it's really immaterial. Gun control in America is against the law, whether you like it or not.
Right, and you did mention that several times in the book about how society feels about issues today or yesterday. That really should not have any impact on the understanding of the Constitution.
It has nothing to do with it.
Right. Sheriff Richard Mack, again, a great man, great American, the author of The Magic of Gun Control. Do yourself a favor, listeners. Pick it up. Pick up a couple of copies. Give them out. I want to thank you again for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to talking to you again.
Thanks a lot, Dave. See you soon.